Listening to the news all week can be a huge headache, and wait, wait, don't tell me, the NPR News Quiz is like ibuprofen for the aching mind. As a bonus, Tom Hanks recently guest-hosted an episode, so listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me with special guest host Tom Hanks on the NPR One app and at npr.org/podcasts.
Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we'll take a look at HBO's latest entry into the prestige drama category, The Young Pope. And we'll examine a well-regarded recent Western, Come Hell or High Water. But before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books, comics, and other stuff for the NPR website.
And with us this week in our fourth chair is our friend Gene Demby. Gene, what are you getting up to these days?
I'm the co-host of the Code Switch podcast.
All right, so first up this week, if you spend much time watching people amuse themselves on Twitter, you may have seen quite a few Young Pope jokes floating around. I don't want to say I was doing some of them for these guys on the mic a few minutes ago, but maybe I was. And even if you don't, HBO is looking for its next buzzy drama, and rather than go with another fantasy show like Game of Thrones, it's going with the very, very offbeat The Young Pope. Starring Jude Law as the fictional first American Pope, Pius XIII, The Young Pope was conceived by the great beauty director Paolo Sorrentino, and it also stars Diane Keaton as a nun. Now, Gene, you grew up Catholic, is that correct?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we were going to go over to Gene for his take. I don't know whether I'm so much looking for your take as a Catholic, but just your take as a person trying to parse The Young Pope. What did you think of this show?
So first, I should say, my girlfriend, when we first started watching this, the first episode of the show, she's like, I might have to turn to you a few times and ask you, like, Catholic questions.
Right, sure.
But she was like, so is this how it is after those episodes? I was like, no. Not at
right.
all. I have no idea what to make of the show. It opens, the first episode and the second episode actually open with dream sequences,
yeah.
which, like, the show is, like, really heavy-handed in its messaging, but still really opaque.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah.
You know? Like, there at one point, I was watching the third episode of the series, and my girlfriend walks in. She comes from outside. The opening credits of the show are, like, a meteor flying through all these paintings.
Uh-huh.
And at the end, as you see Jude Law sort of walking from left to right, the meteor sort of comes outside of the painting and slams into this priest. And she was like, what is the show about? And I was like, that right there. that right there is the show.
Because basically what you get from this show is it begins as Pope Lenny, Pope Pius XIII, as he names himself, is beginning his papacy. He's not that young. We were talking about this before. He's like 50-ish. So he's young for a pope, as we were saying.
I appreciate that he's defined as young, as a 44-year-old.
Right, absolutely. It makes us feel...
Young for a pope, that's me.
It makes us feel vital. What you get is a lot of kind of him, because he's a new pope, he's first got to go out there and kind of make his first address. And these first couple of episodes really center around him kind of trying to set up what his image is going to be and how he's going to approach being the Pope. And he brings in Sister Mary, played by Diane Keaton, who's the nun who essentially raised him after he was left by his parents. Mm-hmm. You get a lot of kind of this intrigue of these cardinals. These guys are all sort of, you know, intriguing all around the Vatican. What did you think, Glenn?
I don't understand this show at all. There was a moment, Linda Holmes, in an upcoming episode, so I'm not going to spoil it too much.
Sure.
But we see Jude Law playing Lenny Bilardo, Pope Pius XIII, Bishop of Rome, Vicar of Jesus Christ, successor of the Prince of the Apostles, Supreme Pontiff of the Universal Church,
Lord of the Vandals,
Primate of Italy, Archbishop and Metropolitan of the Roman Province, Sovereign of the Vatican City State, and the Servant of the Servants of God, getting dressed to I'm Sexy and I Know It by LMFAO.
Yeah.
And that was the moment that was so, as Gene was saying, so heavy-handed, so on the nose, gorgeously shot, and kind of funny. And I looked for the Cenobite with the puzzle box, you know, pleasure and pain inseparable. That's what I felt in the moment. I couldn't.
Yeah.
This feeling I had, it's like, do I love this?
Yeah.
Is that what that is?
Right. So, and I think what I noticed about this show, it starts and, you know, by the time this comes out, this episode has been available for a week or so. It starts with this shot of Jude Law emerging from a giant pile of babies. Now, yes. It's not gross in the sense that they are living, crawling babies. It's just a lot of babies.
I love that caveat. That's a great caveat.
He sort of emerges from the pile of babies.
As one does.
And the thing is, the show, we were talking about this before, the show then after that initial maybe 10 minutes, the show really ceases to be that weird for quite a while.
Right.
And it's only that weird kind of intermittently. And in the middle, it's almost kind of House of Cards-y. And
very.
You get just a lot of people whispering and scheming and a lot less of this kind of Sorrentino's really rococo. Is that what I'm going for? This very, very elaborate staging of everything, which is sort of suitable for the Vatican,
sure.
I will agree.
Sure. I mean, I saw 5 episodes of this because I couldn't stop watching it because there's a phrase in operant conditioning called intermittent reinforcement.
Yes.
Where you keep tapping that lever like you're a rat in a Skinner box waiting for something.
Yeah.
Or you're pulling the lever of the slot machine waiting for the thing. And because it doesn't come all the time, you just keep pressing.
I used to make the same argument about watching American Idol.
Yes, exactly. Oh, yeah. There are these moments of high absurdity in this straight out of Italian 60s cinema. And then there's, you know, I saw 5 hours of this. I think I saw 4.5 hours of priestly whispering in vast empty rooms.
Yeah.
Portentous smoking.
Portentous smoking. And then a kangaroo.
Okay. I was really, really hoping you weren't going to mention the kangaroo. My whole next setup was going to be, and then there's a kangaroo.
Right, okay,
and
go.
At one point, there's a whole thing where they introduce, like, the Vatican has been given this kangaroo, and there's a discussion of, like, shall we send it off to the zoo?
A gift from the Australian Foreign Minister, Holy Father. We thought we would donate it to the biopark.
What do you mean, biopark?
The zoo.
Not on your life.
So many of Jude Law's line readings all have this kind of, this will happen, turn, because I'm evil.
Yeah.
And he decides to loose the kangaroo on the grounds of the Vatican, presumably due to evil.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point later on, he's walking through the courtyard and looks up and just comes face to face with the kangaroo. And that's it.
That's when I decided that because he is named Lenny, we will call the kangaroo Squiggy.
So let me try to engage a little bit with what I think this is, right? The thing that's interesting to know about this is it already aired in Europe.
Right. Last fall.
Yeah. Where it was actually very popular and very, very well reviewed. I do think this is the kind of thing that, to employ broad stereotypes, this is the kind of thing I think Europeans are more accustomed to embracing than Americans are. Because I do think it's weird and it's very self-consciously artsy. And I think for Americans, there's some baggage that comes along with that because you do, when you watch The Young Pope, you see the hand of the director. You hear maybe more timpani than I've ever heard in any show ever. If anybody ever wants to know what's a timpani sound like, watch The Young Pope. It's the kind of kettle drummy thing.
Sure.
You hear it a lot, and it usually means evil. It means if you missed it from the line reading, you get it from the timpani. And it does feel heavy-handed a lot of the time.
Stop it! How dare you shine a light on your Pope? What you're doing is more than a simple lack of respect.
I don't know if you deserve me.
But like Glenn said, first of all, it's kind of weirdly addictive. I've seen the first 3, although I didn't go right to the next one. I thought about going to it, which is a lot more than I thought was going to happen after I'd watched about the first half hour of this show. And I was like, this is just too bonked for me. I can't. But then by the time I got through 3, I was like, maybe watch another one.
So this is a 10-episode season that we're getting here. And you know how, like, when we talked about on This Is Us, and they were, like, just tearing through massive chunks of plot to the point where I think I even asked, like, are they going to sort of run out of story here?
Mm-hmm.
In this thing, it's, like, 2 hours of, like,
will he give a speech?
This is sort of the anti-that.
And at the same time, once he gives that speech, and he gives that speech, spoiler, he gives the speech, at the end of the second episode, it really feels like that's a dynamite ending of an episode. And I felt like if they had squashed the first two episodes into one and maybe like cut some of the portentous smoking and some of the dream sequencing, it would have felt a little more like kind of a tight House of Cardsy intrigue drama. I'm in the same boat with you guys. It's like confusing, but kind of weirdly compelling, and also dull, and also mysterious.
Yeah, it's funny because I think you're right that it would be tighter, and you could lose a lot of that stuff, a lot of the portentous smoking. But the portentous smoking is what they're there for. The portentous smoking is kind of the cushy pleasure of this show for people who like this kind of thing.
The thesis statement of the show is when they have this conversation about whether he should be smoking in the Vatican.
Olivetta, smoking is not allowed in the papal palace.
Is that so? Who decided that?
John Paul II.
The Pope?
Yes, the Pope.
There's a new Pope now.
There is a kind of a sort of I'm the Pope now thing that is very, very Captain Phillipsy, if you remember
I'm the Pope now.
There is a very I'm the Pope now. And I do think you have to recognize that some of this, they're not joking, but it has an element of humor. It does have a wink to it. You know, you are meant to notice how kind of grand it is in a way that sometimes is supposed to be funny. I am curious, Gene, since you are Catholic, how do you feel watching it from that perspective? Like, do you watch that and think like, yes, this is my perception of the Pope in the Vatican, or not?
My experience with priests has been that they curse far more than they do on this show. The thing that was weird about this, and I don't know if it was trying to make any sort of like broad doctrinal or theological points, but like, it was hard to tell if he seems to be like evil. But it's hard to tell if he's just, like, less conservative than his predecessors or, like, some kind of nihilist, right?
Right.
Like,
yes.
He is even contradicting himself.
Yeah.
Well, that's, I think, one of the limitations of it, at least so far, is at the heart of this, we have an anti-hero, a classic prestige drama anti-hero.
Absolutely.
He is basically Vic Mackey from The Shield. He's Tony Soprano. He's latter-day Walter White, which means that, also, he can do no wrong. I mean, he does a lot of wrong, but he's always six steps ahead of everybody else. Mm-hmm. The whole dynamic of the show is one note, like, I have upended you. You can't defy me.
Yeah.
And that's going to get old.
Well, like Frank Underwood gets old on SSR.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
You have to challenge him. And I don't know that in the early going they've given him anybody where I look at them and say, oh, this person could really be a challenge for him, except Diane Keaton. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether that's where they're going. Mm-hmm. But I do think the treatment of her character in some ways is promising to me, in the sense that I think that is where a lot of the character stuff that I think is good in the show is coming out of the relationship he has with her.
There are shows where we watch and I'm bored and I sit there with my arms crossed and I'm bored the whole time. And I found this show kind of weirdly addictive is probably too strong a positive,
but very
compelling. And I did find myself watching it as a mystery, being interested in where it is going with all this stuff. Where do you go with the setup of these first few episodes? Like, what do you do with the repercussions of this particular person taking power in this particular situation where he's supposed to be infallible?
Yeah, and it's funny because that's a situation where, for the purposes of this part of it, if they hadn't already announced a second season and they had said, boom, this is it, we're done, I might feel better about it.
Yeah,
this is the kind of story where I worry about the kind of season six of the young Pope.
Yeah.
He's not as young as he used to be. Because, I mean, people tend to remain Pope for a long time.
I think what we're struggling with here is that this was written and directed by an Italian. It is hugely popular in Italy. Because I think that I'm going to go out on a limb and say that the Roman Catholic Church has a different place in day-to-day Italian society than it does in America. This is also an Italian's idea of what Americans are like. They come over and they start kicking down the doors, and my way or the highway. I think there's a disconnect that I'm feeling that is a cultural one as much as it is a dramatic one.
I think it's also the way this show is getting reviewed is drawing a lot of parallels to the current political situation in America. And there's a certain, like, well, Sorrentino is clearly commenting on Donald Trump. This show was written and filmed in, what, 2014?
Started in 2014.
Or at least started, yeah. Yeah.
And so I wouldn't put too much stock into that.
Right. Although I think a lot of those questions about the shape of power have been emerging in Europe for a long time. So I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility that kind of current political climates are at play there. And I think that there are people for whom, if you asked them, who are the three most powerful people in the world, right? I think the world is divided into people who would never forget to include the Pope.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And people who would never include the Pope.
Right.
And they would be thinking entirely in terms of governments and maybe companies. Mm-hmm. But when you see him having it explained to him and sort of explained to the audience, you know, you speak to
a billion
people or however many it is, who shape their lives and their morals and their sense of right and wrong around you and around what you say. It's interesting to see that recognized as an important seat of power.
And if this was made in Hollywood, many things about it would be different. One of the things, I think, is a very good chance that it would treat believers very differently. Mm-hmm. These people are not necessarily ridiculed, these people who show up and are...
No.
They are not held up as figures of fun. Their devotion is a thing that, in many ways, he's pushing back against. He's saying it's not the right kind of devotion.
Right.
But the devotion itself is not something that we have a distance from. It's something that we're supposed to be a part of.
Yeah, it's interesting. Anyway, I think that we can say, young Pope, interesting. Different. Not like anything else you have on TV. Like I said, a co-production between HBO and Italian television. And, you know, we'll see what happens to Lenny and the kangaroo Squiggy. All right. When we come back, we are going to talk about a movie that Stephen mentioned in his What's Making Me Happy, but that otherwise we did not get to in 2016. And we are eager to talk about it. It is called Hell or High Water, and it's a Western. And we're going to talk about it right after this.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/happyhour.
This is Tom Hanks. Do you know an undiscovered musician who deserves a break? Well, we have an idea for them. NPR Music is holding a tiny desk contest to find one great unsigned musician to play the iconic Tiny Desk concert series and tour the United States with NPR Music. All you have to do is shoot a video of your musical act playing an original song behind a desk and submit it by January 29th. Learn more at npr.org/Tiny Desk Contest.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. You know, it is awards season, as I'm sure you know, and in addition to everything that's coming out right now, from Hidden Figures to La La Land, there are some contenders that came out earlier in the year, and we want to keep up with those, too. Now, according to Rotten Tomatoes, good for not necessarily nuanced reviews, but an aggregation of critical opinion, the second best reviewed film of 2016, behind, I should say, Zootopia, is Hell or High Water, a modern Western starring Chris Pine and Ben Foster as brothers who rob banks, and Jeff Bridges as a Texas Ranger hot on their trail. It was directed by David McKenzie and written by Taylor Sheridan, who also wrote Sicario, if you remember that one. We wanted to talk about this Western. Stephen watched it last week, spoke a little bit about what he liked about it. I'm going to kick over to Glenn. What did you think of this this movie that we decided to watch for this week?
I loved it. Didn't think I would. If you just read the tagline of this, it's two bank robbers who get chased by two Texas Rangers, and one of whom is 1 week from retirement. You get a sense of a film that's different than the one is. I think this is very stylish, especially in that opening tracking shot, which is really just shows a command of filmmaking, and not particularly like over the top stylized.
Right.
It's interested in digging into the genre and having it intersect the economic crisis in a way you don't necessarily think of noir, Western, whatever the hell this thing is. It's a kind of a mashup of things. It finds human moments in a way that if it was a Tarantino film, those human moments would be two people sitting around talking about pop culture. But instead, we get a scene when the two marshals go into a diner and this little thing happens.
So what don't you want?
Pardon?
What don't you want?
Oh, well, I think I'll just...
You know, I've been working here for 44 years. Ain't nobody ever ordered nothing but T-bone steak and a baked potato. Except this one from New York tried to order trout back in 1987. We don't sell no trout. T-bone steaks. So either you don't want the corn on the cob, or you don't want the green beans. So what don't you want?
I don't want green beans.
I don't want green beans either.
Steaks cooked medium rare.
Can I get my steak cooked
that
just a...
want no question.
There you go. The film stops dead. This propulsive plot stops dead for a moment like that. There's plenty of moments between Jeff Bridges and Gil Birmingham. And the violence that is deployed in this film is deployed in a way that doesn't feel, again, doesn't feel stylized, doesn't feel romanticized, isn't there just to create cinematic suspense. It's sudden, it's capricious, and it's real. And that's why I really dug this movie so much.
Yeah, and I do want to shout out Margaret Bowman, billed in that scene, by the way, as T-Bone Waitress.
There you go.
And I will never forget her. Gene, what did you think of this movie?
I loved this movie. It was really, really, again, beautifully shot. It was like very, the colors were very warm, lots of like yellow and browns. Jeff Bridges plays the lawman who is a couple weeks away from retirement. He is kind of unlikable. He says all this racist stuff to Gil Birmingham, who is Native American.
And I think part Mexican as well.
And part Mexican, right. Yeah. So he just says all these like just janky asides to him about, you know, hitting the bottle. Just really terrible things. But also, you feel the sense that almost like he is not comfortable in his clothes. He sort of always seems like really like irritated, but really good with people. Like, he's just very easy, and he can get people to talk to him. And so at first it seems like, oh, poor, like, you get the sense that Jeff Bridges is chasing after these guys who are basically good dudes.
Yeah, and then they have their reasons.
Right, their reasons are legitimate and sort of understandable, even if you don't agree with what they're doing. And then something happens in the movie, and the tenor changes really subtly, but importantly, and you realize that, like, oh, actually, when you rob banks, there are a whole bunch of things that happen that could potentially happen. Yeah. And once I didn't realize when I was watching it that the guy who wrote Sicario wrote this, but it made complete sense afterwards because every moment after this thing happens is unbelievably tense. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It is like just like every moment seems like it is fraught with mortal danger.
Yeah.
It's a movie that is both like really suspenseful but like really funny and clearly really likes all of these characters quite a bit.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I think there's real affection by Taylor Sheridan, the screenwriter, writes this movie with real affection for these characters and real affection for their motivations, even when there are clearly reasons to not do some of the bad things that are done and that have increasingly grave consequences. You basically have two sets of brotherly relationships at the heart of this movie, and kind of brotherly ribbing that goes on between these two pairs, which could just be Black Hat and White Hat, but are more complicated than that. You talked about Jeff Bridges and Gil Birmingham, Glenn, but also this relationship between Ben Foster and Chris Pine. And boy, Chris Pine.
Yeah,
I would not have necessarily thought Chris Pine is who I would cast in my Western, but that relationship, and again, every time it seems like it's going to be simple, like Chris Pine is kind of the noble, you know, he's got these noble aims, but he's got this hothead screw-up brother, they just find ways to muddy up the waters. I mentioned this when I was talking about this movie and what was making me happy. The way that they make a modern Western in rural Texas using concealed carry as a catalyst. There's some commentary through the way the movie plays out about concealed carry. Mm-hmm. It is also used to create an element of high stakes throughout this film. You cannot just rob a bank in Texas and not expect to get shot at.
Yeah.
And so I loved this movie, and I loved how economical it is in so many ways.
Yeah. One of the things, and you mentioned concealed carry, but I think more broadly, this is a movie that to me shows a lot of thoughtfulness in the way that it employs gun violence, which is kind of an integral part of the Western, and particularly the modern Western. And so many modern Westerns, Glenn, you mentioned Tarantino. I would also mention the recent remake of The Magnificent Seven, and I guess the original Magnificent Seven as well. So many have such kind of operatic mass casualty gun fights. This movie does not play out like that.
Yeah.
This movie uses gun violence, as you said, economically, and I think with purpose. I don't think there's any shooting that happens in this movie that isn't there for a reason. I don't think there's any shooting that happens in this movie that's just there to keep people interested or keep the plot going or to look cool.
Yeah.
And in fact, there is some gun violence in this movie that I think is very carefully calculated not to be cool, not to be glamorous or particularly exciting, to be in a way mundane, in a way that makes it more grave to me. So I very much appreciated that about the film. And I think you also, when you look at the performances, Stephen, you mentioned the relationship between Chris Pine and Ben Foster. It's so interesting to look at both of these guys because, as you said, when Chris Pine was first, when he was cast as Kirk as in the start in the new Star Trek movies, I think there were a lot of people who kind of thought, well, okay, and waited to see how that was. I think he's been good in those, but he's also done some really kind of low-end romantic comedy stuff that hasn't gone over very well. He was like in Lindsay Lohan's like Just My My Luck movie. I mean, he's been kicking around a long time. And I forgot until today that Ben Foster was like a kid actor who I recognized and knew from certain things, that he was in this
Disney Channel
show called Flash Forward.
What?
He was on Freaks and Geeks. And I had kind of disassociated adult Ben Foster from kid Ben Foster. They're both so good in this. Mm-hmm. And that's on top of what you said about Jeff Bridges. I think these guys in this movie, the funny thing about Chris Pine, I agree with you, maybe not obvious for your Western, but there is a skinny, slouched posture that Chris Pine has in a couple of scenes where he has the sort of almost looks like a fence post carriage that I actually think is one of the most authentic looking postures for a guy who lives this way that I've seen in a movie in quite a while. And I just, it's true of the young Pope, right? That it's beautiful to look at and visually arresting.
Oh, okay, sure.
But there are moments when I looked at this and I looked at the way they shot the slouch of Chris Pine's shoulders. And I thought, they're working very hard on the visuals in this movie as well. And one of the funny things about it is, this often happens when we're preparing for a show, is that the two things that we're talking about do kind of come together and begin to kind of teach me something. I think both of these projects, right, The Young Pope and Hell or High Water, are both incredibly stylized, and they're both very carefully employing aesthetics that are appropriate to the kind of story and also to the setting. I think in some ways, Hell or High Water is just as skillfully composed to look like a beautiful Western as The Young Pope is beautifully composed to look like this ornate...
Whatever the hell it is.
I don't know, but to look like this ornate, artsy, Italian... Yeah. Pope show. Like, and I found them both very pleasing in that regard, even though The Young Pope is so weird. And Hell or High Water, to me, is story-wise much more accessible, and I think will be to a lot of people. They're both really employing kind of stylized visuals to perfect themselves. I would love to hear what any of you who have seen The Young Pope or who have seen Hell or High Water, not intentional, by the way, mixing Pope and Hell, just happened. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us at PCHH and tell us what you think. When we come back, it is going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Amazon Studios and Bleecker Street, presenting Patterson, the new film by Jim Jarmusch, the writer and director of Broken Flowers and Only Lovers Left Alive. Starring Adam Driver, winner of the Best Actor Award from the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, and Goshifta Farahani. Experience the official selection of the Cannes, New York, and Toronto International Film Festivals. Patterson. Now playing in select theaters.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Over the weekend, I watched a movie called Loving while preparing for our Oscar coverage. Loving, if you don't know, is about a couple in Virginia named Richard and Mildred Loving. He was white, she was black, and they ran afoul of Virginia's anti-miscegenation laws, i.e. laws against interracial marriage. Now, last week on Pop Culture Happy Hour, we talked about the movie Hidden Figures and talked about biopics versus historical dramas and how movies like this and Hidden Figures are kind of a combination of the two. And what I really liked about this movie is how well it dodged so many of the conventions of historical dramas and of biopics by simply telling the story of this very straightforward love affair. And it's so much about their relationship. It spends as much time, if not more time, showing him laying bricks than it does in a courtroom. You think it's going to settle into this big kind of combustible courtroom drama in a way that would be so conventional. And instead, every time it makes the choice between quiet and loud, it almost always picks quiet.
It's a very quiet movie.
And with these wonderful quiet performances at its center, Joel Edgerton and Ruth Negga, who managed to be wonderful and without ever really giving you anything that feels like an Oscar clip. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, we're watching all these movies going into the Oscars and you're like, oh, that's the Oscar clip. There it is. That's going to be his Oscar clip. No. It's very hard to find in this movie, even though these performances have been very celebrated to the point where it is a distinct possibility that one or both will get nominated. I really liked it, even though, or perhaps because, it's so quiet.
I endorse this wholeheartedly.
Yeah, terrific movie.
Great
Loving.
Great pick. Loving. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Two things. The first is I am halfway through the 8 episodes of A Series of Unfortunate Events, the Netflix series that dropped this last weekend as we taped this, based on the books by Lemony Snicket, a.k.a. Daniel Handler, about 3 hapless orphans and the evil Count Olaf who tries to get their fortune. Patrick Warburton is playing Lemony Snicket in this. It's got Joan Cusack. It's got Asif Manvi. It's got Catherine O'Hara. So I'm in.
You're in.
I'm in. It's got Neil Patrick Harris playing Count Olaf, and the choices he is making in that role are, believe it or not, smaller than the ones Jim Carrey made in the 2004
film. I believe it.
And that's important. That turns out to be very important because he is, when he needs to lean into the mustache twirling, he does it. But a lot of this character lives in this kind of impatient frustration with people not respecting him. And that's where a lot of this performance lives. And it's really funny, and it's not big, you know, in a thing that is as stylized as this thing, because it's art directed all to hell. It looks great. But you need something like that, some humanity, because it is so stylized. So I really like that. He's living in the kind of Dr. Horrible space there, mm-hmm, where you can kind of see behind the villain. The other thing is a comic book called Department H from Dark Horse Comics by Matt Kent, art and writing by Matt Kent, but watercolors by his wife, Charlene Kent. Now, Department H is about a murder in an undersea research base, and it's a locked room mystery, and about the woman who goes down to investigate it. And it just gets, with each issue, it gets weirder and creepier, and the kind of dark undersea creatures become part of it in a weird way. And it's really claustrophobic and compelling, and again, stylized art, not straightforward photorealistic. Volume 1, called Pressure, collects the first 6 issues of this series, and it came out on Wednesday as we tape this. So I really recommend people checking it out. You should be picking it up issue by issue, because in each issue, Kent adds like a little cover material on the back or the front that's like an excerpt from a diary or extra artwork or something you don't get in the bound form. So he's trying to drive you to the single issues. But if you don't want to do that, you can pick up the trade paperback. Volume 1, Pressure of Department H. Get it? Depth? Department
I do get it.
There you go.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Gene Demby, what is making you happy this week?
What's making me happy is a show called Chewing Gum, which I'm surprised no one has shouted out before.
I shouted it out.
Oh, did you really?
Of course. Okay. I did.
Well, I also know you're a fan of Crazy Head.
Yep.
And both these shows share an actress, Susie Wacoma. She plays on Chewing Gum. She plays the sister of the main character. Chewing Gum is a bizarre, hilarious show. It's like super oversaturated, lots of colors. The main character character is she's early 20s. She's trying to figure out her life. She's a virgin. She doesn't want that to be the case anymore. But Susie Wacoma is her sister, and she is very, very, very uptight. And she is remarkable in both of these shows. And she's doing something very different. In Chewing Gum, she's like uptight and judgy. On Crazy Head, she's acerbic and sort of off-kilter. I've never seen this actress before. But she's like quickly becoming my favorite thing about these two shows, which are both on Netflix, which you should watch.
Wonderful. Crazy Head and Chewing Gum. Yeah. Thank you very much, Gene Demby. When you recommend quote-unquote clean comedy, it is always difficult to escape the feeling that you are saying you should watch this clean comedy because it is clean comedy and not dirty, nasty comedy. I like lots of dirty, nasty comedy. I like lots of comedy that has swearing and lots of comedy that is not kid-friendly. But one of my favorite stand-ups to listen to is Jim Gaffigan, who I first encountered as a stand-up when I lived in New York. And I remember one of my friends gave me his CD, Beyond the Pale. And I listened to it, and this was my experience in New York of actually being on the train, listening to a comedy thing and realizing I can't listen to this on the train because I laugh and people think that I'm goofy, which is something that everybody talks about happening. But this is my literal story of this happening. If you've heard Beyond the Pale, it's the bit about having someone give you room service.
I just feel uncomfortable when room service comes and I'm in a robe, like I'm trying to seduce the room service guy. Hello, welcome to my room. I'm in my robe, and here's the bed I rented. Is there anything I could do to be more creepy?
And it's very, very funny. So he has a new Netflix special, which is called Cinco, because it's his fifth comedy special. And in it, he talks about his marriage. He talks about his kids. He talks about food. He talks about binge-watching television. It's really kind of ordinary subject material, but it's so, so funny and good. And he is so reliable for me and very prolific. He has kind of new stuff coming out all the time, but he's also just a really hardworking, dependable comic. If you like him, I would also recommend Brian Regan, who I think might actually be my favorite stand-up in the world, who is also, as it happens, a mostly clean comedian. And they're both guys who, to me, just have a style that I very much respond to. So Jim Gaffigan's Cinco, now on Netflix, a new comedy special from him. I highly recommend it. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon. And you can follow Gene at GD215. That's GEEDE215. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katz. Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are hopefully bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Always good to see you, Gene. And thanks to all of you for listening. And we will see you right back here next week.